I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time. And we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring. Hey, this is Ryan Holiday. Obviously, one of the perks of my life is that I get to have conversations with the great Robert Greene, I think one of the best living writers on the planet. You know, we have these phone conversations every couple of weeks. And so what he and I thought we would do is we said, why are we just doing this privately? What if we just got on Zoom and recorded it and people could listen? Because maybe some of the things that we're going through, that we're thinking about, some of the stuff that's influencing his writing could be beneficial to everyone. So I'm really excited to have this episode for you. We talk about the rampant irrationality of our time. We talk about political polarization. We talk about falling for scams and cons, which I think is its own pandemic these days. We talk about conspiracy theories. We talk about how one, if one wishes to be politically or socially engaged, how one does that strategically, how one does that rationally, how one does that and actually has some real effect or impact on the world. Talk about all this and more. I love talking to Robert. I feel like, I've been having these conversations with him since I was 18 or 19 years old, and it has transformed how I see the world. It's helped make me into the writer that I've been lucky enough to become. So I'm so excited to share this with you. Here is my interview with the great Robert Greene. Obviously, you should check out all of his books. And of course, if you have checked them out and want to follow him online, he's at Robert Greene Official on Instagram. You can also go to his website, sign up for his email list at powerseductionandwar.com. Really excited to chat. I feel like in a world that seems like it's sometimes tearing itself to pieces, there's this line from Churchill that I like, where he talks about, as World War II is breaking out, he says, it felt good today to put 1,000 years between me and the 20th century, meaning he was reading and writing about history as a way of calming himself down and getting perspective. And I feel like your books are a great opportunity for people to understand the present by looking at the past.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I agree with the fact that it's kind of calming. It gives you perspective. It makes you realize that the bad days will end, that we're in a particular cycle of history, and that nothing lasts forever. In my last kind of podcast, I was talking about irrationality, and I brought up the story of Pericles and of the plague that hit Athens, kind of drawing a comparison a little bit with COVID. although obviously I recognize the plague is not the same thing as the coronavirus, but it was sort of as a metaphor for what we're going through and the kind of irrationality that erupted in Athens, kind of triggered by this very powerful plague, to give people a sense of 2,000 years, essentially, of perspective on this, or more than 2,000 years, of how these cycles occur and how outbreaks of irrationality occur even in the richest times in history, which is 5th century BC Athens, the height of what we would call rationality, and that it led to a whole century, the 4th century BC in Athens, of incredible irrationality, of superstitious beliefs. It's also the period of Plato and Aristotle, so it was very contradictory. But these things happen in waves. People go crazy. They go insane collectively. It's not just a pandemic of a virus. It's a pandemic of emotions, of irrationality that people can't handle. So very much I agree with you. History gives you a deep sense of perspective and can help you lift some of the depression that comes from being mired in a moment that seems so chaotic.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, you read your books and it's filled with stories of irrational people and con men, and it's filled with stories from history. And I think maybe we look at those and we go, oh, that was a long time ago. It's different now. And then we're surprised when we see those traits or those tendencies reemerge in our modern world.
Well, you know, it's hard for a human being to have perspective, particularly on its own period of time. And you said, this time it's different. That's the classic phrase that people used when there was like some kind of bubble, like the South Sea bubble, or the crash in 2008, or the depression, you know, some new scheme comes for making money, which is clearly like an elaborate
cryptocurrencies and...
Yeah, right. It's obviously an elaborate type of Ponzi scheme. And everybody kind of points to, well, look at the past. There were all these other kind of, you know, schemes going on, and look how they ended. And they go, no, this time it's different. You know, but one thing I talk about in the 48 Laws, I think is very relevant. I talk a lot about how to form a cult.
Yeah.
Charlatans and con artists. And the thing about a cult is when you're in a cult, you have no idea that you're in it. So you might be in one right now, you, Ryan Holiday, or me, Robert Greene, but I wouldn't realize it, because the nature of a cult is it envelops you in a narrative of this is what the world is. These are our enemies out there. This is our cause. This is what unites us. And it creates this kind of fake and very simple and vague narrative of what the world is like. And when you're in that bubble, you don't realize that you're in it, because by the nature, if you did realize you were in a cult, you wouldn't be in a cult any longer. So that's the kind of danger that people are living in right now. You know, this is a time where con men and charlatans are proliferating. As I said in the book, when you go through a period of transition where great big grand belief systems such as Christianity or organized religion, particularly in the West, or communism or something like that falls apart, people need to believe in something. It's a deep human need. And when that disappears, we're going to start believing in these little microcosms, these little mushrooms that emerge after the rain, with all these sort of little kind of belief systems that kind of combine technology and religion, et cetera.
I'm not sure I've ever been in a cult, but certainly, and I know you saw some of it, American Apparel, Dove Charney was able to create kind of a cult-like atmosphere inside the company. And one of the things I found to be most strange about it, and I kind of had one foot in, one foot out, especially towards the end, because I always was doing my other own things, but it would be when there would be obvious flaws or faults. So you know, you're being criticized, or it's being sued, or there's the front page of the New York Times is arguing this or that. What I noticed is that instead of that waking people up, it drove them deeper into the narrative. And obviously the scientific term for this is cognitive dissonance. I'm curious how you see cognitive dissonance playing out these days.
Well, cognitive dissonance is like the golden principle right now. And essentially what it means is you believe in something, you come to believe in something for whatever reason. And when evidence comes in that what you believe in is patently false, it confronts you with a dilemma. Either you were kind of stupid in the beginning to believe in this in the first place. And as the philosopher Schopenhauer says, people will admit to anything, but they will never admit to being stupid or having less intelligence than another.
Sure.
So it's very difficult to admit that you were stupid. You know, it's like the last thing someone will confess to. So the alternative is, instead of believing the evidence, you double down on your initial belief and you say, it's the other person who's wrong. And you see this all the time. Like, so for instance, there's this scare that Antifa is coming to Idaho and is coming to your small town. And it's just like Facebook hoax. It's a complete hoax. Somebody was pulling their leg. And so hundreds of people come out with their AK-47s to defend their little town in Idaho against the Antifa that are coming. And of course, they never come. And then they say later on, it's clear that it was a hoax, but they say, no, we scared them from coming because we were there. Or that congressman in Texas, Gohmert, you know, he's ranting against masks being helping in the coronavirus. And then he catches the coronavirus, the ultimate irony.
Right.
And then he says it was the masks that caused him to have it. These are cognitive biases that are happening at left, right, and center. And, you know, if you, the main thing would be like, if you, and everyone's going to see through this, but if you voted for a president, for instance, or a leader, and it ends up that that person is not what you thought he was or she, it's obviously a charlatan, a con artist. That's the ultimate thing. You have to admit that you were conned, and nobody wants to admit that. So you'll double down on your belief that this person is right, and you will then you'll be even fiercer in your defense against these enemies that he or she is facing.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the ultimate message through all your books, whether we're talking about planning a strategy in 33 strategies, or whether we're, you know, trying to build some power dynamic, or we're trying to achieve mastery in a field. I feel like the thread through all your books is a sort of an unflinching commitment to reality, even when it's inconvenient, even when it means you have to go, oh man, that was so dumb. Why did I do that? Or whether it's taking responsibility for a failure or a mistake, that it seems like, and I think you say, like, we have to take to reality like a spider to its web.
Right. I mean, you probably know this. I mean, you have to understand people. It's not like I'm accused, like I'm somehow exempt from human nature. So I understand the process. But, you know, I'm actually not as secure and certain of myself as people think I am. Whenever I hold a belief or I'm writing a book, I always start with the premise that I'm probably wrong, that I'm actually quite ignorant, that my idea is pretty stupid. And I look at the evidence on the other side and I examine it and I try and convince myself that my initial idea was right. And if it isn't, then I change it. But it's very painful, because you want desperately to hold on to those beliefs that you had initially. So the number one thing about reality is confronting yourself. The fact that you are a limited human being with a limited cognitive abilities, you are emotion-based, and so your relationship to the world is usually through thick layers of illusions that come from the media, that come from your childhood, that come from your culture that you live in. And that you have to cut through those layers, but you have to confront yourself and see yourself as the source of them. I mean, have you ever ever realized that you made a terrible mistake about something and had to reassess you, Ryan Holiday, and your own intelligence? Isn't it quite painful?
Yeah, it's like we'll do just about anything to avoid having to do that.
Right. So, I mean, the thing you want to do in life, I'm a great believer in looking at the evidence. So, and looking at facts and things that are happening, information, historical context, et cetera. And it's the evidence and the facts. That's how I write my books. It's probably how you write your books. It's the evidence and the facts that tell me what reality is. I don't begin with my own preconceptions. I let the stories tell me what's going on. Sorry.
And don't you think, like, from an individual in terms of like who you're married to, who your friends are, and then from a leadership perspective, you know, who is on your board of advisors, who works for you, how information bubbles up through the hierarchy. I think the other thing, like if our mind is inherently sort of not our friend in that respect and tries to deceive itself, it seems like we have to build systems and relationships that counterbalance those forces so we have access to reality through somebody else's perspective. They can be like, Robert, you're being an idiot. What are you doing?
Well, that's why you read books. I mean, it's great if you could have intelligent people around you to have discussions and tell you, Ryan, that idea is shit. You're right. Stupid. But first of all, people will never do that because everyone is so political. Everyone is so sycophantic. They'll say, Ryan, I love your idea. Your book is fantastic. It's very hard to get objective criticism.
Sure.
When you read Nietzsche, when you read Marcus Aurelius, when you read Thucydides or any of these writers, you're getting a perspective on reality that has nothing to do with you personally.
Sure. Right?
They don't know you. So you don't have to get upset if they're bringing up facts and ideas that kind of challenge you. It's kind of an exciting process. And I often love the fact of reading great books from hundreds of years ago that literally challenge how I think. You know, I'm reading now from my new book, Things of Descartes, who's somebody I don't like, his philosophy is very strange to me, but I'm forcing myself to read it. I'm entering his world, and it's really having a profound effect on me. So entering someone's different reality, that's what books do to you. They enrich you, and they show you that your own look on the world is limited, and you can look through it through the lens of another culture, another gender, another period in time. And if you're not reading books, then you're going to probably be in those layers of illusion are going to be so damn thick, you're never even going to realize it.
Yeah, there's a quote I've liked from General Mattis. He says, if you haven't read hundreds of books, you're functionally illiterate. You know, we think like, oh, I can read. But the reality is, if you're not reading, what good is that skill?
Right. Right.
I think we should talk about conspiratorial thinking, but that's so loaded that maybe I thought I'd start with something else that I think is equally prevalent. And I was just writing about, I think we're also seeing a lot of magical thinking. So conspiratorial thinking is, you know, like these people are out to get us. This is how things are operating behind the scenes. But I think, you know, magical thinking is, oh, the coronavirus will just disappear, or, oh, a vaccine will happen and all of this will go back to normal, or, you know, my ex is going to come rushing back through the door any day now. She's going to realize what a mistake she made. It feels like people are living in a fantasy world of their own, you know, kind of magical thinking.
Yeah, and that's very true. And, you know, it's obviously the source of falling for a con game or falling into a cult or believing in a conspiracy.
Like, I'm seeing it a lot where, like, parents seem to think, like, oh, school is important.
Oh, I know. I remember my thought.
Is it like, I'm seeing it like these parents are like, school is important, so I'm going to send my kid to school, when it's like, school is important, of course, but it's also the middle of a pandemic. So just because you like something or just because you need something, if I would have wanted to visit my relatives in Europe during the Second World War, my need for doing so does not change the fact that there are German U-boats patrolling the Atlantic and I'm going to get sunk if I try to go see them.
Yeah, but if you say that, Ryan, like I tried to say on my last video about the plague, people are going to be coming, oh, are you comparing the coronavirus to World War II? You know, people don't know how to think in metaphors anymore.
Sure.
But, you know, what I was going to say was, I don't know if this is accurate. It's a thought that came to me, and maybe I need to think it through more deeply, but I think a lot of it comes from 60, 70 years of an entertainment industry that envelops us in these stories that have like drama and then a happy ending and a consequence and a conclusion.
Sure.
And it creates this kind of way of thinking that the world is just like this, right?
Sure. You know,
and so we're kind of, and ideas have to be entertaining, you know? So if I give I noticed this one time when I gave a talk in Toronto, and I was one of the top speakers. There was like 12 of self-help gurus, including, Anthony, what's his name?
Tony Robbins. Yeah.
And they were like yelling and stomping around the stage and yelling and had videos, and it was just like a clown show.
Right.
Right. And then I got on the stage and I had no video, and I'm just sort of talking about mastery. And then I realized you've got to entertain people. You've got to put your ideas inside these little sugar pills. You've got to make them titillate them and excite them.
Sure.
And this has been going on through radio, through television, through the internet, through social media. And now people think that the only ideas that are legitimate are these ones that fill into these little capsules, like a log line for a screenplay.
Right.
This is what reality is, you know? The pandemic, it's plandemic. It's
right, it rhymes, it must be true.
5G,
yeah.
You know, it's whatever it is. These little tiny tidbits of information that people glom onto. It's very entertaining, it's sexy, it's nice to believe in. And as you say, it's complete magical thinking. I don't know if my theory is totally whack, but it came to me the other day that was sort of...
No, I think that makes sense. It's funny, Musonius Rufus, one of the Stoics, he was saying, if you see the audience... Like if the audience is responding, it's a sign the philosopher is not delivering hard truths. He was like, they should be sitting there in complete silence because their mind has been blown. But I think you make a good point. Like we've lost the ability, or maybe we've never had it, but we're struggling with the idea that a lot of truths are uncomfortable. A lot of truths are complicated. And a lot of times an idea is maybe the difference between the path we should take and the path we shouldn't take. There might only be 3 or 4 percentage points of difference between the two. Like, you know, I think like you're also seeing this in the pandemic. There's got to be some magical drug that just treats it. Or there's got to be, you know, even masks. Like, oh, so I'm wearing a mask. Now I can just go about my normal life as if everything is fine. And it's like, no, actually, we're trying to chip away at this thing from all these different angles, and that there is no one silver bullet solution, but a lot of bullets that you eventually kill this thing with, and we don't seem to be able to do that. We want to glom onto the one thing, and then that's the only thing.
Yeah, I mean, a virus is a very boring thing. Right? It's not a living organism. First of all, you can't anthropomorphize it.
Right.
And say, you know, we're going to kill this thing. It's not a living organism. And it's very boring. It simply lives by this rigorous math, right?
Right.
If it, you know, they have the number 1, 1.1, if it infects more than one person at a time, it can expand exponentially.
Right.
And exponential increases are very hard for us to understand.
Sure.
And they're very powerful, right? So, and then the solution is also really kind of boring. It's so simple, and, you know, like wearing a mask and being socially distant and putting up with that kind of sacrifice for 4 months. How unmanly, how unmasculine,
sure.
Wearing a silly little mask. I mean, you know, oh my God, no, it's much better to believe in something much, a vast conspiracy that this was some nefarious Chinese person planted it so that it would destroy America, that some cobble of people somewhere in Eastern Europe are doing this to destroy Donald Trump, or that, you know, on and on and on, and that maybe, yeah, as you say, you know, one thing will solve it. It's as if people can't think of two things at the same time. It's magical thinking, but it's also black and white thinking.
Right.
So if some reason it comes out that masks aren't the only solution, that, you know, there are limits to masks, well, then that was totally false. Fauci was wrong. Trump is right. Masks are silly. No, there's nuance. Science is full of nuances. Masks help. They don't do the whole thing. You have to do this other thing. It's not very sexy or exciting. It's not like CSI Miami.
Right.
It doesn't have an exciting ending. It's not all masks. It's not people shooting with guns. It's very simple. People don't want to believe in something so simple and boring as that. You know, they
I think this goes to the point of your book Mastery too, which is like people want to think that to become great at something, it's 100% genetics, or they want to think it's 100% hard work, or they want to think that it's, you know, it's 10,000 hours. So if I put in 10,000 hours, I automatically become this, you know? And the reality is it's complicated that I think a lot of these things are art more than they are a science. What I like about your book is you're like, no, it's really, really hard. But if you follow these basic principles more often than not, you will get close to where you want to end up. And I think that's also with the 48 laws of power. I hear people do this all the time. They go, but some of the laws contradict each other. So therefore the whole book must be false. It's like, yes, life is complicated. Sometimes you have to do this and sometimes you have to do that. How is that hard for you to understand?
Well, even taking it a step further, I said in the intro, and I used the last law to say I am contradicting myself. Be formless.
Right.
Don't listen to a writer. Think sometimes that maybe he's wrong. And every chapter ends with a reversal, saying that this law sucks, that you have to look at it from the opposite angle. And still people go into that black and white thinking that, you know, he's contradicting himself. But the thing with mastery was, I was actually worried that this book would not sell at all because the message is so kind of not what people want to hear, right? Particularly in an age where you've got your phone in front of you and it has such power and you can do whatever you want to a degree that nobody in history has ever experienced. And so it creates this belief that you can have the same kind of effect with anything in life, that things should become easily, that you should be able to hack your way quickly through, you know, some app that comes that you get or whatever and get power really quickly and easily. And so I thought, God, I am swimming against the tide because I'm telling you, I'm delivering some bad news. The human brain evolved millions of years ago. And, you know, over the course of you know, let's say hundreds of thousands of years. And in one generation, you're not going to change the human brain because of technology. So you have to understand that our brains are designed to practice things, to learn, to be patient, develop discipline. What a bleak message. Oh, I've got to put in that many hours. Oh, I have to be disciplined. Oh, I have to learn how to fail. Oh my God, I don't want to hear that. But the good news is the book has sold well and it's really resonated with a lot of people. So I think in this culture of so much bullshit, of so many sugar pills, of feeding people so much crap, that I think a lot of people, their human nature revolts against it. Something inside says, I don't want that anymore. I want a dose of reality. I want somebody to splash some cold water on my face.
Do you think, I know you're fascinated with Eastern philosophy. I think Western philosophy tends to be so logical and attempts to be so rational. Do you think there's maybe some additional merit then in the Eastern stuff where it seems like these sort of Zen koans and these riddles and some of these questions they ask, it almost seems like they're embracing the paradoxical nature of reality and the contradictions and the unknowableness of it all?
Yeah, very much so. Where I found that the most interesting was when I did my war book and I got into strategy and Asian strategy. And, you know, you would think strategy is a very kind of heavy Western concept. You know, you do this and this results. It's very cause and effect, consequential. Right. Step A will lead to B, would lead to C. And you plan out and you map it, you know, von Clausewitz, whomever. And then you go into Sun Tzu and it's like, whoa, what is he saying? It's like this reality that we're dealing with is very nuanced. It's very hard to say. It's like an art, as you say. And you take action A, and it won't lead to B. It could lead to C. It could lead to D. So where do you go? And I was confronted with this. I decided I would read a version of The Art of War that went through all of the Chinese characters. I obviously don't read Chinese, but it explained literally what each character meant. So you were reading a much more direct translation. And then it made me realize that this is not how we think, right?
Sure.
So to give you an example, he talks about potentiality of power. So you want to put, the art of war is to put yourself in a position, this could be in business or any strategy, where you have the potential of great momentum, of great power, right? It's not about A will lead to B, it's about a position.
Right.
And that position is can be somewhat nebulous. And what are these positions of power? He compares it to a stringing of a bow. That bow has potential force behind it, or a boulder on top of a mountain. And then he talks about how you can do that in warfare. And I thought, this is a whole other way of thinking. It's much more holistic. It's much more nuanced. It's much more artful. And it's more closer to reality. So to get back to your point, people think of Zen as a kind of religion. And it is theoretically a religion, something that I'm delved into very deeply. But more than anything, Zen is a philosophy of reality. is trying to connect you to what the world really is like. And it starts from the premise, which Buddhism does, that your mind is inherently living in illusion because you're separating yourself from the world. And the world isn't like that. You actually are a part of the world that you're in. So that way of thinking deeply, deeply excites me because it contains, you know, possibilities of things being the opposite. So something that's so extreme turns into its opposite, which is something very kind of a very powerful part of Chinese philosophy. And in the laws of human nature, I talk about how people who appear to be so one quality are actually disguised in the opposite quality, and they continually turn into each other, you know, the shadow side of human nature. Sure. These are things that I've, you know, absorbed from years of reading Asian philosophy.
I wanted to go back to this idea of sort of people have some of these irrational beliefs. They've picked up these stories, this entertainment sort of bias that we have. Nassim Taleb talks about, he's like, stories are powerful. And he says, the only way to beat a story is to replace it with another story. And I was curious, given your writing on seduction, which to me, I sort of expand seduction out from just, you know, sort of sexual or relationship seduction. But it seems like what you're really talking about is if you want to combat this propensity for entertainment or this magical thinking, we have to combat it with a better story or something, you know what I mean? So how do you suggest leaders and people think about, like, if you, let's say you knew someone who was starting to believe in plandemic, you can't just go, that's stupid, you're an idiot. How do you walk them back from that?
Well, it's not easy. If I had the magical answer to that, there's no magical pill for that either.
Right.
But you have to kind of enter their world first a little bit to understand, you know, where these things come from. So, you know, part of that, as you say, is understanding their story. And you would have to maybe watch Plandemic, which I'm afraid I did. It gave me a headache.
You weren't convinced?
No, I wasn't convinced. What I did see through was all of the tricks, the music, the narrator's voice. I totally deconstructed in my mind all the little tricks that it used to create this illusion of some kind of menace, etc. But I watched it and I could see its seductive power in the sense of what we were talking about, where people want to believe in stories. They want a villain. They want something simple and easy to digest. They want a kind of vague conspiracy in which they can project their own little neuroses and problems. I saw its seductive appeal. And so maybe in that sense, what you're talking about is I would have to create a kind of counter narrative that also was seductive. But I don't know how you do that. Sometimes people need to be confronted with reality.
Sure.
But they need to be confronted with reality in a way that doesn't offend them, that doesn't say you're stupid. You know, I talk about that in human nature. And I see that every day in the world. You know, there's somebody you disagree with, you think they're wrong. In fact, you're sure of it, and you'd call them on it. All you're doing is making them more certain that they're right. Sure. Because nobody wants to admit that they're stupid. So you have to be able to understand people's insecurities and what led them to believe in Plandemic in order to create a possible alternative scenario. So I don't know what that would be. I've had moments where, lucid moments where I thought of a way to maybe appeal to people in this sense of creating a kind of narrative of the science of it and the virus and kind of the excitement that comes from, you know, actually, you know, because one thing that irritates the hell out of me is people generally love and trust science. They do it tacitly. They do it because they drive a car and they assume that the technology is there.
Sure.
They fly in a plane. They go to a doctor when they have a disease, and they tacitly believe that there's an expert in their science and it will solve problems for them. But science isn't sometimes very sexy, you know? It doesn't necessarily please you.
Sure.
It's an inconvenient truth. And so you have to find ways to narrate the idea behind science, which is a lot of what I'm doing in my new book.
I was just thinking, yeah, it's like if you're...
what would be your counter narrative?
Well, I don't know exactly, but like, let's say we're thinking, and someone lives in some Rust Belt town in a mobile home. You know, they're not in good shape because they don't eat well because they live in a food desert. Maybe their community has been decimated by opioids, and the job market is not robust for someone who isn't educated. When you hear this idea, like, let's make America great again, that taps into exactly how you're feeling. And I think the rational community, if you will, and I think that can include a whole swath of the political spectrum, seems like has not done a particularly good job. You know, I forget who said it, but the idea leaders are dispensers of hope. You know, there's not really a narrative that dispenses hope, that dispenses agency, that dispenses anything worth believing in.
Yeah, I misunderstood your question. Yeah, I completely agree with you. And so like a mistake that the people in the Democratic Party or on the left will make is not having a counter slogan to make America great again.
Right.
People need slogans. People love slogans. Is build back better is so awkward.
You know, right.
It's not the same, doesn't have the same ring. So Democrats have always been so weak in that because they believe they're technocrats. They believe that if they just tell people the truth about the economy, but it's not seductive. Right. And I always go back to the only Democrat in my memory who did this was John F. Kennedy. He was a genius at marketing on the level of Trump, because that is the one element that Trump is good at. You know, Kennedy had the new frontier. You know, he realized that we're emerging out of the boring Eisenhower years, which really weren't so boring.
Right.
But you know, he created this idea. And now we're returning to our pioneer myths. Our frontier is now outer space. We're going to go to the moon. We're going to be the first people to go to the moon. We're going to be so technologically advanced that we're like the pioneers in the 19th century. It was really powerful and seductive, and it worked brilliantly. I agree with you completely. You need to seduce people, and you can't be afraid of doing that. You know, even, you know, like Bernie Sanders, he created a cult-like following. Let's say it what it is. It's a
right.
cult. But he was actually pretty good at creating these kind of slogans and these kind of quick ideas that people could digest about the 1%, et cetera. You might hate him, but he was good at it. But so many Democrats, particularly the ones that we nominate, suck at it, and they suck at it royally because they think they just need to deliver bullet points, a list of things that we must do. We must do this for education, this for health. And you can just see people falling asleep as they do it. I completely agree with you. I misunderstood your question.
No, I think it applies to the pandemic too. Like, I'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, I remember in the campaign in 2016, Hillary's response to make America great, which is actually, you know, as nationalistic and stupid as it is in a lot of ways, it makes sense. There's a sort of an immediacy sure. that makes sense. And her response to that, instead of a better story, was America is great because it is good. You know, and it's like, good is not as good as great. That's what words mean. And second, you're telling people who are unhappy that actually they're wrong to be unhappy because America is already great. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're not, you have to tell a better story. And it seems like we struggle to do that.
Well, the thing is, you know, to be a leader today, to win an election, is extremely complicated because we're very divided.
Yeah.
Right. We have these little niche groups, these little beliefs, you know, identity politics, whatever you want to term it. And even on the right, they have their little niche groups. So to unite the country to win an election, you have to create a narrative. You have to tell people, this is what it means to be American.
Right.
And nobody ever does that. I can't recall in my lifetime, you know, you could say Trump somehow, some does, or Ronald Reagan perhaps did, is an example. But what does it mean to be an American in 2020? It's a very strange time we're going through. We're a very diverse country with all of these, you know, it's not the same in Wisconsin as in California and New York. And we have these different isolated pockets. What will unite us? What will create a grand sense of we are a country? We don't need to hate each other. I can actually appreciate that Trump voter in Michigan. He's an American as I am. He has the same, you know, frustrations with the healthcare system that I do. What unites us? How do you create a narrative that makes people emotional, that makes people actually want to think that this is what the future of America? Damn it, if I could just get inside of a politician's head to create that narrative, That's like the one thing that's so missing. And there's so much potential power behind that.
Well,
and
no,
it's scary power. It's not like a Nazi type power.
But it is very volatile power. Like, I mean, we're recording this the day after the 19th anniversary of 9/11. And to think, you know, there was all that energy, you know, those planes crash into those towers and government, the United States government has an opportunity. What story are we going to tell ourselves about this event? And then how are we going to direct that energy? You know, the war on terror is a story. It's just probably the wrong story. And we ended up telling a story that, you know, cost America trillions of dollars, thousands of lives, and almost certainly made us less safe than we were before. And why is China ascendant and America somewhat stagnant? It's, you know, China didn't spend several trillions of dollars, you know, for very little gain in the Middle East over the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, the narrative that you create has to be reality-based to some extent, and it has to be pro-social, you know? So the reality, the narrative of this is our enemy, we must destroy them, the war on terror, was kind of the false way of uniting people. So I agree with you. There is a kind of cult-like Nazi way of uniting people behind a cause that is very evil, that can take the energy in a crowd and can make it very, very dangerous. So yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, if I'm thinking about a narrative nowadays that unite people, it's, look, we're the most powerful country. Well, we used to be. I don't know how long, much longer we can say that. But in quotes, we're the most technologically powerful country in the world. Look what we've done. Look at the science. Look what we've created. Look at our business. Look at our culture, et cetera. And why can't we see this is our new forefront, the new frontier to do Kennedy, to bring back to Kennedy? We're going to solve all the incredible problems in the world through being a magnet for the greatest thinkers in the world. We're going to solve global warming, and we're going to make it economically profitable. You can make that narrative pro-social. It doesn't have to be evil and cult-like. And I think Kennedy's was like that, or even Reagan's to some extent, you know?
No, I totally agree. How do you personally, when you see all this happening and it's aggravating and it's frustrating and it's disappointing, how does one prevent themselves from giving in to despair? I mean, that's something I think about. Like, how do you not just go, this is crazy, I'm going to be like Montaigne and I'm just going to retire to my tower and read my books for the rest of my life?
Well, that is kind of what I'm doing. I'm kind of being like Montaigne. I am kind of retired to my tower and working on my next book. I mean, I'm an exception, so it's not really easy, fair for me to say, because, you know, thank God I have books to write and I can absorb myself in over 3,000 years of history and get outside of this time. But, you know, some perspective will help. And, you know, I had a chapter in my Laws of Human Nature about the generation phenomenon, and how there's a great book called Generations by these two writers that came out in the 90s that show these incredible patterns through history that happen in sequences of four. And
the fourth turning, right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That's not the title of the book.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And there's a kind of a crisis generation, which I believe is what is millennials, people who lived through 20, this crash of 08, and now this. And then there's the revolutionary generation, where something new is created, where people are so tired of what's going on in the world, particularly young people, because it's only young people that ever really create change. And change is very necessary in this world. And so the only hopeful thing is that I think young people are so sick of the narrative they've been fed about the world, particularly from boomers, about this is what America is, this is what prosperity is, this is what our future is, that they're so sick of it, they're so tuned out of it, that if they could ever get the energy together, they could create something very powerful and new. My only hope is that people are going to get tired of this, and that this is what has saved us in the past. That we've gone through these deep moments, and sometimes these moments can last well over 100 years. There can be the dark ages in our history that last four centuries or something like that, you know? But at a point is reached where the human spirit rebels and returns to its origin and returns to something powerful and healthy. Because we know we don't like, you know, if you eat a lot of junk food, you feel sick. Your body feels sick.
Sure.
If you consume a lot of bullshit information and things that are just entertainment on the internet, you kind of also feel sick. Like you're disconnected from who you are, from your own body, from the world. You rebel. You're sick of it. And so we need, in some ways, I don't want to, people are going to kill me for saying this, but we also somewhat need a kind of second revolution in America of, you know, bringing all of the great things of our country and updating them to where the world is right now. And my only hope is that young people are so sick of the way things are that they're going to be the catalysts of change. I could be wrong, and it may never happen, but that's what makes me not want to kill myself right now.
So let's say that some of this energy does come together. What I think, and maybe there have been moments, right? There have been marches in the streets, whether it's about George Floyd or whether it's about the Parkland shooting or whether it's about climate change or the, you know, the Women's March, or whatever it is. It seems like we get these moments of energy, but the wave crests before it has a chance to do anything. And I think part of the reason that that seems to happen is that the entrenched interests are so good and so used to sort of parrying these blows that they don't end up landing. And so I'm curious, like, what's your advice to an incipient activist movement that is fighting an enemy that is not playing by the rules? Like, if you're Belarus right now and yeah. You are up against the full power of the state, what do you do?
You do what you're doing, and those are brilliant, beautiful examples, and I'm following it with great interest. I mean, look what happened in Ukraine. I was recently in Ukraine. Ukraine's an amazing, beautiful country. People are very smart there. There's a lot of great things of technology that are coming from Ukraine. They overthrew one of the most corrupt oligarchies in modern times. Now, things aren't perfect there. There's still levels of corruption. They're still fighting it. But, you know, I was reading in the paper this morning in the Washington Post about somebody I think you really need to include in your book on courage.
Okay.
I think he's the most courageous person in the world today, and that's Alexei Navalny, right? Okay. The guy who was poisoned by the Russians.
Sure.
Unbelievably brave. Read the Washington Post article today.
Okay.
Unbelievably brave what he's put up with. Completely incorruptible. And his strategy for fighting the most entrenched, you think it's bad maybe in the United States, try fighting against Putin and Russia, and you'll see that you're hitting a block of cement more than anything. But it's not impossible. And the solution is, because I've researched this a lot and thought a lot about it, is visibility. You need to be out there in the streets, and you need to not let your energy dissolve, and you need to be constantly publicizing the corruption. And you can't be naive. So what you're talking about is entrenched powers co-opting the anger on the streets. And so Citibank will have an ad saying, "We're all with you, you know, George Floyd, blah, blah, blah." Right. They're co-opting it. They're right. Co-opting your energy, and they're turning it into their own thing. You must call them out on that. You must not be seduced by these little crumbs that they try and throw at you. You need to keep your narrative together, which is there is rampant corruption in this country. There are oligarchs, whatever country you're talking about. You need to be revealing that for what it is. And if you look at Alexei Navalny and why he's so brilliant, you talk about seduction. He creates these YouTube videos. I don't know if you've ever watched any of them.
No.
They have them with subtitles. They're fantastic. He has managed to create these, I don't know, 20-minute, I don't know how long they are, I don't remember, videos detailing the corruption in Russia. He gets drones to pass over oligarchs' mansions, and he films their ponds full of ducks and swans and their tennis courts and their swimming pools, and he puts it together in a really powerful video and says, "Look, Russians, this is what they're stealing. They're stealing your money. And this is how our president, Medvedev, has $1.4 billion put into his estate. Meanwhile, you are starving and you are dying from the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera." They're powerful. So you have to be entertaining and you have to be constantly visible. If you're marching in the streets, you can't let the energy dissolve. And you have to create a narrative that's strong, and you can't be naive. You can't let yourself be seduced by these people who are trying to co-opt you.
And I've been fascinated about the civil rights movement lately and reading a lot about it. I think maybe one of the things we get wrong about it too is that, you know, we think it's like, oh, you know, Martin Luther King just took people to the streets. And so we think like, oh, what we need to, you know, to get change is just to have a lot of protesters or demonstrators. Like when you really think about what like the Montgomery bus boycott was or some of his garbage boycotts, he wasn't just demonstrating, but he was exerting real pressure that that the leaders had to alleviate. And the only way to alleviate it was to get into his demands. And so I think that's one, like, you know, we do this, remember after 2016, there was a March for Science in America or something. Like, that's not exerting any pressure on anyone, and there's no goals of that move. Do you know what I mean? We just think that organization is key, but there has to be another component.
Well, I mean, but Martin Luther King definitely had what I'm talking about. He definitely wanted to keep these things visible constantly in the presence. Sure. But what you're saying is true. You have to be strategic. That's the difference.
Yes.
Right? And Martin Luther King was a brilliant strategist. So he understood that the goal of his campaigns were white liberals sitting in front of their television sets in Janesville, Wisconsin, or in Illinois, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to see images of children 12 years old being beaten by brutal black cops and their dogs, et cetera. And they're going to be awakened to the reality of America. And to do that, he had to make things extremely visible. He had to be constantly out on the streets, and he had to even provoke the other side. So one of the things that, you know, we tend to create these saints, and Martin Luther King was not a saint, but he was very human. But he had a decision in one of his rallies, whether somebody proposed letting school children, 11, 12 years old, participate in a demonstration, which would probably end up violent. And people said, oh, Martin, you can't do that. That's terrible. That's not ethical. And this very religious man, this preacher, this priest, you know, said, no, it's the right idea. And he did it. And it was very, very powerful. It was one of the key moments in the movement. So yeah, there are times when you can't exert pressure, like on you want police departments to change, and you're out on the streets, or let's say the election is, you know, there's fraud and there's like the 2000 movement where the Brooks Brothers revolution occurred and they all, you know, tried to change the results in Florida. You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the leverage in that particular case is only going to be by demonstration in mass numbers. I mean, both components are important. So in Belarus, it's the fact that 100,000 people in a small country are in the streets of Minsk, basically running the risk of being beaten or killed. And that is incredibly powerful. It's remade the people in the country. It has a snowball effect where everybody wakes up. So visibility and being on the streets is one component that's very important, but you have to also be strategic and do what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And that does seem like something people who have kind of turned up their noses at your books right now, especially millennials, I think need to be reading, because they're, when the other side is not playing by the rules, although you do have to maintain the moral high ground, which you talk about. It's like, on the one hand, you got to be kind of a Lyndon Johnson. You have to take the moral high ground here, but then in the smoke-filled rooms or in secret, you got to know how to grab somebody by the balls and twist, you know? And I think we're lacking that.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about it today when I was reading the paper, and I don't remember what the story is, where I'm seeing, you know, like Republicans can play very dirty.
Yeah.
You know, they play this kind of asymmetric warfare where they're willing to do anything when it comes to limiting voting rights or working with the post office. They'll do anything to keep on power. And the Democrats, I don't want to get involved in that kind of nasty stuff. You know, it's too dirty. We're pure, blah, 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 blah. Man, I've been hating that for my whole life. It makes me sick. You know, read about Franklin Delano Roosevelt one of our greatest presidents and one of our most liberal. That guy, the person who wrote the best biography, called it The Lion and the Fox. He was Machiavelli incarnate. He was incredibly strategic. Nobody played more hardball than Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he knew how to do it, and he was successful at it. And so, you know, that's what the world is like. And if you're going to organize a movement, you have to realize that you can, your hands are going to have to get a little bit dirty. And then even Martin Luther King was willing to get his hands dirty in a demonstration. And even Gandhi, I talked about in my war book, Gandhi was incredibly strategic. He knew that if he did passive resistance and they were being beaten up by white British people, policemen, those in England would be seeing this and they'd be revolted by it, disgusted by it. He was willing to have that happen. He was very strategic. If Gandhi and Martin Luther King were strategic people who knew how to play tough and hardball, why can't you get off your high horse and be more strategic and be willing to get your fingers a little bit dirty and play a little bit dirty? And you're not going to lose yourself. You're going to win.
Well, no, it's like Bill Belichick talks about the Patriot way and no ego and all that. And then, you know, he's also looking for every, you know, every possible thing he can do up to the line. And sometimes he's willing to see if he can get away with crossing the line. You know what I mean? And that's what it takes to be dominant at that level, I think.
Or look at Churchill in World War II. You know, read the book I recommended to you, The Bodyguard of Lies. A great book. You know, the levels of deception and these things that kind of cross an ethical boundary that you would normally never do in wartime, he was willing to do because the stakes were so high. Well, the stakes are pretty high right now. And sometimes you have to be willing to go a little bit past that boundary.
So I thought maybe we'd close with some of the, maybe to bring it full circle. It strikes me that there are some people who are just sort of being manipulated because they're uneducated. They're being manipulated because they don't have the training that we're talking about. They're being manipulated because they're vulnerable, whatever. And then it also seems like there's a part of this that it's people, there's this, that quota, you can't con an honest man. It seems like some of the people that are falling for this, they should know better. And in fact, why they don't know better is because they think they're the ones that are getting the better deal out of it. Do you know what I mean? It's like manipulators are being, I think Machiavelli says, like, he who deceives is most easily deceived because I'm just curious what you think about that.
Well, I mean, look at Trump and Bob Woodward. Trump is the one who's incredibly deceptive, who likes to, let's just call a spade a spade. He lies a lot. You know, I don't think anybody, even a Trump supporter, would deny that. And here comes Bob Woodward, who kind of says, you know, I'm going to write a book. And Bob Woodward has 18 books behind him revealing what he does. He like rips you to pieces. He shows your innards. He makes you look as ugly as you can. Right. And he agrees to it. The deceiver was deceived. Con artists are often conned. I have the story in the 48 Laws of the greatest con man that ever lived in America, Yellow Kid Vile, and how he was conned by these two very beautiful women on a boat once, you know, and he realized that, you know, I'm very much open to it. The idea is, you know, when we look at the world, we like to think of evil people and victims. It's part of our black and white magical thinking. There are evil people out there, and there are poor, oppressed victims. And the thing about con, the reason I try to show in con artists or with cults, is I'm fascinated by the psychology of people who fall for it. And it's not so much that they are victims in this particular instance. They want to believe in the con. There's an old Latin expression, I wrote it down here, mundus vult decipex ergo decipiatur. The world wants to be deceived, therefore deceive them, is the expression. People want to be fed some convenient, beautiful truth. You're going to have easy money. We're going to do this little thing here, and you're going to get thousands of dollars without ever doing anything, right? Wow. Okay, I'll do it. You know, or whatever the story is, whatever the con is, you want to believe in it. You're a sucker. You're a dupe because of human nature, and we all have that part of us. You want to believe in this easy route to power and money, right? So the end thing is you have to be responsible for yourself. You can't be whining that you were the victim, that you were conned, or that you were deceived. Of course, you'll very rarely ever admit that. You have to build rational defenses in your mind. You have to be willing, and this comes from a lot of reading, to question everything, to question your own beliefs, to say, am I actually in a cult? Maybe I am. Have I actually been conned? Maybe I, Robert Greene, have been conned, and I have been conned myself personally. You have to look at yourself. That is the last line of defense for any kind of world we live in with so much deceiving and conning going on.
Yeah, I remember you tell a story, I think it's in 48 Laws of Power, about this con they do where they approach someone and they say, hey, do you want to fix a boxing match with me?
Yeah.
And then you're in the, you think you're tricking other people. And then they stage this elaborate ruse where one of the boxers gets killed and then they flee with the money, but you don't ever tell anyone about it because you would have to admit that you were fixing a boxing match.
Yeah. It's the old Russian trick of kompromat. So if you're compromised in the actual con, you're never going to come out and go to the authorities because A, it shows how stupid you were, and B, you're admitting guilt on your own part. So that's one of the oldest cons in the book, yeah.
Yeah, no, a compromat is a fascinating and very relevant thing these days. And I think I was reading an interview with an FBI agent and they were saying, you know, it's not... People think that to be compromised means that you're a traitor, like you're somehow some double agent. And he's saying being compromised just means there's a reason that you can't be fully honest. It's like you have a secret or you have some shame or you have something you don't want to admit. And that's what it is. And I think, you know, when people talk about this election interference and all this stuff, like it's not just politics. I mean, there's college professors who've been taking research money from China. We have, like, this is why I think ethical lines and holding yourself to a high standard is so important. You don't want to be compromised because once you're compromised, you're not yourself anymore.
Well, it's the chapter in 48 Laws of Power about your reputation. Mm-hmm. And there is an element that isn't maybe so ethical in that it's a power thing. But it is ethical in the sense that your reputation is your most important thing that you have. And if you sully it in the least sense, particularly in this era with so much visibility and social media, where one wrong step will resonate, you know, the waves will go in a matter of minutes across social media, you have to be very careful. And you have to see that there are all kinds of compromising factors out there. So yeah, I myself have been in a position where people have been offering me money from somewhat dubious sources. And I say, no way, because I know it'll come out at some point. And people will go, oh, look, Robert Greene, how can we trust his books? He's actually receiving money from this somewhat corrupt group or that somewhat corrupt group. You know, I'm not saying that I'm pure, but I'm very much aware that I myself have been the target of compromised campaigns before. And I take a step back and I go, no, my reputation is the most important thing that I have.
Well, no, and that's why, you know, controlling your ego is so important. I'm not at the same level, but every once in a while, you know, you get a television request to be on RT or something. And on the one hand, you're like, oh, that would be good. And then you're like, ah, I know why this is happening, right? And, or you know, we can also corrupt ourselves. Like, how many people get themselves in trouble because 3 years ago they said something dumb on Twitter because they couldn't control their emotions, and now, you know, now they can't be president or whatever it is.
But it's hard. You know, we tend to separate ourselves from other people and point fingers. And I know how easy it is to fall for these things. Mm-hmm. I know, like, if you're in a group situation, you're working in an office like we have when we were in American Apparel, and we recently discussed this. The pressures that you're feeling to conform and to maybe do things that you normally wouldn't do because you're being asked to do it. And the group pressure is very powerful. And then you'll let slip some of those ethical principles that you have. I know I've felt that pull myself. And I maybe even at some points have slipped a little bit. I'll admit that. You know, I understand how difficult it can be. But as you say, at some point, you look at yourself and you go, this is who I am. This is what I stand for. It's more important than any kind of momentary friction I'm going to get from the boss or from whomever. And I'm not going to go past that particular limit.
No, I love it. Anything else we should cover that we haven't covered?
I don't know. I think we covered the world as it is. How about you?
I don't know. I think the thing I've struggled with, I'd be curious, is like, it's so hard to know where we are in the sort of levels of emergency. Do you know what I mean? Like, when is this the early sign and there's still something that can be done about it? When is the, you know, it's like, let's say it's a, just to take it out of the complicated political context, let's say you're convinced that we're entering an economic bubble. So you could sell right at the beginning of the bubble and, be totally safe. But as they say, the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And so there's this tricky balance of like, do you ride it up, you know, and risk maybe taking it too far? Do you risk taking your chips off the table too early? And so I think in a political and in a social context, we're in this weird environment where, you know, where are we on the spectrum of like, where are we on the spectrum from, you know, America, the dream, and, you know, Russia or Germany? And how do you know?
Well, if I had that answer, I would be the most powerful man in the universe, you know?
Right.
We don't have perspective. To be someone who writes books, you have to have humility and realize there are limits to what you know. So I read a lot of history and I see a lot of patterns, and a part of me says that things are pretty damn dire, that certain guardrails in our democracy are frittering away. But to be honest with you, what scares me more than anything is the levels of irrationality and magical thinking and people not able to kind of look at themselves and be somewhat self-aware. And that disconnect from reality, and as I say, I kind of think it's from decades of being entertained and being kind of brainwashed, is what frightens me the most. Because even if, let's say, Trump is gone, let's say people are coming in, they're fixing things, et cetera, that's not going to change this consciousness that people have.
Sure.
That is, you know, kind of like the equivalent of eating junk food. So that thing, that part of it makes me a little bit depressed, because you need to change people's consciousness more than anything on a deep level, you know? And the other thing that's very frightening now, that we've seen before in history, it's not the first time, is the extremity of the partisanship, of the tribalism that we're going through. And, you know, I could point through other moments in history that have been equally tribal, of course, before social media, which has only exacerbated it. But it's kind of like this hall of mirrors that you enter. You can't argue with people anymore.
Right.
Because the moment you say, this is what I think, and you're challenging them, oh, you're just this, you're just a liberal, you're just a Trump supporter, you know, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. I get that all the way. Oh, Robert, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. Whereas in fact, you're the one that's drunk the Kool-Aid, but the people who drink the Kool-Aid think everybody else are the ones that have drunk it. That's the nature of it. Even in Jonestown, where the expression comes, you drank the Kool-Aid, they thought everybody outside of Jonestown had drunk their own Kool-Aid. That's the kind of world we live in. It's like Alice in Wonderland, which Jared Kushner was saying, ironically enough, kind of is the book that encapsulates the Trump presidency. But that's kind of the world we're living in.
No, gaslighting is the operative term too, not just because of what it means. Like it's rooted in the story of a man who's sort of flicking off the gas lights and slowly tricking, I think, his spouse about it. But if you expand that out, it's like some gas is leaked into the room and it's made us all irrational. And we can't think straight. And the worst part is we can't think straight, but we think that we are thinking straight. And that about sums up the nightmare that we're in.
I think that about sums it up. You're right. I can't think of a better way of putting it.
Well, it was amazing to talk to you, and let's do this again for sure.
Yeah, and you have a book coming out, don't you?
I do, yeah, Lives of the Stoics, September 29th.
I encourage all of my followers and readers, if you don't, I'm sure all of you read Ronald Holiday, but you really should go out. This is going to be a great book. When is it to come out?
September 29th.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.